Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a post-election analysis from U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. We will discuss the irony that in the recent midterm elections, the Republicans ran largely on Democratic issues such as the minimum wage, poverty, median income, real unemployment, underemployment, and part-time work, while Democrats ran away from all these issues and President Obama. We will also discuss whether in 2016 these issues will be debated, particularly by Democratic presidential candidates who will be running to the right or center, unless Senator Sanders is somehow allowed to be in the presidential debates. Then we will speak with William Salatin, the national correspondent at Slate who writes about politics, science, and technology. He's the author of Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion Wars, and we will discuss his recent articles at Slate, A Victory for the Left and Forget the Republican Mandate, to try and understand why the recent elections had the lowest turnout in 72 years, and whether in the next 2 years, Obama and the Democrats can concentrate on winning the next election rather than acceding to the Republican fiction that they just got a mandate from an election in which only 36.3% of the electorate voted, meaning the new Congress represents 19% of Americans. Then finally, we'll look into the U.S.-China climate change deal just announced by President Obama and President Xi Jinping at the APEC summit in Beijing. Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines, joins us to discuss whether these new pledges go far enough to address the dire crisis of global warming and whether China will be able to achieve them. Not to mention Ken Obama, who will be facing a hostile Congress beholden to polluters like the Koch brothers, who helped elect them. And joining us now is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history and is the chairman of the U.S. Senate Veterans Affairs Committee and sits on the Senate Budget, Energy, Environment, and Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Sanders.
Oh, good. Great to be with you, Ian.
So, Senator Sanders, you have called the recent midterm elections the dismal voter turnout an international embarrassment and are introducing legislation in the Senate to make Election Day a national holiday. The bill is called the Democracy Day Act of 2014. Where does it stand?
Well, we just introduced it today. And we hope to gain support for it, and we hope to rally the American people behind the idea. And the reason for it, as you've just indicated, is A, voter turnout in this last election was abysmal, to say the least. Almost two-thirds of the American people did not vote. And number two, I think it's important, and a Democracy Day could help us move in this direction, to focus attention on the need to develop a vibrant democracy where voter turnout is high, where people are well informed about the issues, where there's honest debate about disagreements, where big money and the billionaire class are not buying elections, where we don't have voter suppression. So I think what Democracy Day, making Election Day a national holiday, is about is not only making it easier for people to vote, but it is also to focus attention on the ways that we can become the kind of democracy I think most of us want us to be.
And you've noted, Senator Sanders, that according to the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, the U.S. ranks 120th in the world in average voter turnout. I was recently in Australia where they have compulsory voting and you get over 90% of people voting. And even though you have a very conservative government that just got elected in Australia, they had to run on a very liberal issue, which was 6 months pregnancy leave for all Australian women and including their male or female partners. That is something that I don't think even the Democrats in this country would even touch. And the point being that if you have 90% of your people voting, the politicians have to respond to the people, not just the backers who give them money.
Ian, that is exactly correct. I mean, the reason that Republicans could win an election, as they did last week, where two-thirds of the people don't vote, is because the people most in need, the young people, we have an election in which my guess is, but I haven't seen the final statistics, some 80% of people under 21 years of age did not vote. And some 80% of low-income working people did not vote. So if those people who are the future of America and those people who are hurting the most economically are not participating in the political process, why will anybody in Washington pay attention to their needs? So if you had a voter turnout of 70% in America, where people who are making minimum wage said, you better vote, you better raise my minimum wage to a living wage, or where young people were saying, you better create jobs, because youth unemployment is close to 20%, or the college students saying, you better lower interest rates on my student indebtedness or make college more affordable. You know what? The world here in Washington would radically change. But when you have one-third of the people voting and billionaires like the Koch brothers contributing huge sums of money and lobbyists all over this place, the result will be the rich get richer and everybody else gets poorer.
So why is it, do you think, Senator Sanders, that the average American does not understand that simple contract in a social democracy where you vote for a government that protects and good stewards of the tax money that you give them and that you therefore in return get government services from the tax money? It's a simple system. It works in many other countries. Why is there this large-scale abdication?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it's a complicated question, and I don't know that I know all the answers, but this is what I do know. Clearly, there is massive dissatisfaction and disaffection with what's going on in Washington. So people start off with the assumption is, why should I vote for any of these people? You know, I'm working longer hours for lower wages. My kid can't afford to go to college. I don't have any health care. What are these people doing? Why should I vote for any of them? That's number one. Not a good answer, but that is what I think many people think. And second of all, I think that the media does a terrible job in this country in helping the American people understand what is going on and who stands for what. So you literally have millions of people who will say, well, I'm unhappy, throw them all out. Doesn't matter whether somebody's a progressive or a conservative. No, 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 just bring in new people. Does it matter what the ideas are of the new people coming? No, 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 because ideas and policies don't matter. We don't hear them discussed at all. So I think a lot of what goes on and has to do with corporate media is politics is perceived as a game, not as dealing with the terribly important issues facing working families and the middle class. So instead of engaging in a real discussion as to why the middle class in America is collapsing, why are we the only major country on earth without a national health care program? Why is 95% of all new income going to the top 1%? How does it happen that we have a major political party, the Republican Party, that rejects science in terms of climate change when the scientific community is telling us this is the great environmental crisis facing us? How does that happen? You have just gone through an entire campaign where those issues are virtually not discussed at all. And the corporate media is much more interested in the polls and the money that people raise and the dumb things that people say rather than helping us engage in that political discussion. So I think there are a lot of reasons for it, but the end result is most people, there was a poll that came out a couple of months ago that said 63% of the American people could not name the political parties that control the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. So we have to raise political consciousness. We have to have serious debates about serious issues. Not so easy to do, but I hope that maybe by pushing this Democracy Day, we can move in that direction.
Well, of course, what was ironic about this recent midterm election was that the Republicans ran largely on Democratic issues such as minimum wage, poverty, median income, real unemployment, underemployment, and part-time work, while Democrats ran away from all of those issues and President Obama.
That's true. But then, the day after the election, we learned, to nobody's surprise, I mean, I was talking about this during the campaign, what the real Republican agenda is. It's one thing to say, are you happy with the economy today? And people are clearly not happy with the economy today, despite the fact that it is much better than it was 6 years ago. Let's remember, 6 years ago, the financial system was on the verge of collapse. We were losing over 700,000 jobs a month. Our deficit was $1.4 trillion, the largest in American history, and we were losing combat troops in two wars. Are we better off today? We are. Are we anywhere near where we should be? No, we're not. But here's the irony of all this, Ian, is that the Republicans forgot to tell us what their agenda is. They say, are you happy with the American economy today? And people say, no, we're not. Now, what's the Republican solution? Okay, here's what it is. This is exactly what it is. You're unhappy with the economy today. We're going to cut Social Security. We're going to end Medicare as we know it and move it into a voucher system. We're going to make massive cuts in Medicaid. We're going to cut federal aid to education. We're going to cut nutrition programs, despite the fact that we have more people living in poverty today than almost any time in American history. And by the way, we're going to give huge tax breaks to the rich and large corporations. And we're going to do that because somehow all of that good stuff of cutting programs that working people desperately need and giving huge tax breaks to billionaires, somehow in a miraculous way, this is going to improve the economic situation in America. Well, in my view, that's a fraud, but that is what they are going to be doing.
Well, given that we just had the lowest turnout in 72 years, do you think in the next 2 years the Democrats and Obama will concentrate on winning the next election rather than acceding to the Republican fiction that they just got a mandate from an election in which only 36.3% of the electorate voted, meaning that the new Congress represents 19% of Americans? So, in other words, Senator Sanders, we need you in the next presidential debates.
Is that where this was leading, Ian?
I'm afraid so. I ambushed you, but I really want to talk to you about that if you can.
Sure. Well, look, it is no secret that I am giving thought to running for president. But this is, you know, you don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, gee, I think I'll run for president of the United States. You not only have got to give a lot of thought to it, you have to, if you do it, at least for me, you have to do it in a serious way. You have to do it well. And when you have my politics and when you are, you know, have been at war against the billionaire class forever and you understand what the Koch brothers are about and what the oil companies are about and what the coal companies are about and the military-industrial complex and the drug companies and the private insurance companies, this is the ruling class of America. And these are very, let me tell you what I'm sure you already know. These are very, very, very powerful people who have unlimited sums of money. And what I have to ascertain is whether there is the support all over this country for a grassroots movement. We talk about raising public consciousness a moment ago. We talk about low voter turnouts. Well, can we turn it around? Can we get millions of people involved in the political process? Can we run the kind of dynamic campaign we need to create millions and millions of decent-paying jobs, raising the minimum wage to a living wage, having a Medicare for All single-payer program, transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels and combating climate change? Can we do that? And I can give a good speech, tell you all the reasons why we should do it, but that doesn't mean that political reality is there on the ground. So before I make a final decision, you know, I've got to get a sense from people all over the country to what degree they are prepared to stand up and fight back.
Well, would a national petition drive to demand that your voice is included in the debates so that we can hear these issues? These are issues that the majority of the American people feel strongly about, but they are not being addressed.
Now, Ian, you're right, and that's certainly one of the reasons I am thinking about this. It would make me and I think millions of people really sad if we went through an election where the most important issues were not being brought forth.
Well, we just went through one.
That's exactly right. We sure did. And we don't want to go through another one. And that is one of the reasons. On the other hand, that I'm giving thought to running. On the other hand, if I run, I don't want to run. You know, I have a little bit of, it's not a question of ego or pride. It is a question that I want to defend. It's not about me. I want to defend the positions that we believe in. The need to create millions of jobs and protect the working class of this country and deal with global warming and environmental issues and women's rights and so forth. I want to make sure it can be done well, because if it's not done well, it's probably best not to be done at all. If we become marginalized, if we don't have the resources to run the kind of campaign that I think has to be run, probably better not to run it at all. So to be very honest with you, what I am doing right now, taking this period of time, is to kind of ascertain what kind of grassroots support there is out there. And I should tell you, I've been to a number of states, been to Iowa and New Hampshire and other states, and, you know, the response we're getting is good. But, you know, these are some of the issues that I have to consider.
Well, Senator Sanders, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history and is the chairman of the U.S. Senate Veterans Affairs Committee and sits on the Senate Budget, Energy, Environment, and Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into why the recent election had the lowest turnout in 72 years.
From the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Will Salatin, the national correspondent at Slate, who writes about politics, science, and technology. He's the author of Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War. And his recent articles at Slate are A Victory for the Left and Forget the Republican Mandate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Salatin.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be with you.
And this recent election had the lowest turnout in 72 years. So the question, I think, is, and you've raised it in your article, Forget the Republican Mandate, I guess, is whether the Democrats in the next 2 years, Obama and the Democrats, can concentrate on winning the next election rather than acceding to the Republican fiction that they just got a mandate from an election in which only 36.3% of the electorate voted, meaning the new Congress represents, this is the new meaning the new Republican Congress represents 19% of Americans.
Right. The sort of conventional understanding, the textbook understanding that most people have of democracy is we have these elections, and the politicians are supposed to listen to what the voters said and act accordingly. And so the Republican conclusion from this election is we won, voters voted for us, so you have to switch and enact our policies. And because of the numbers that you just cited, that is a kind of fallacious number. This is a minority, a small minority of the electorate that just voted. And it does matter that more conservative-leaning people came out to vote. It certainly tells that liberals and Democrats that they need to do a better job of getting their people to come out. And they will have to do that in the future if they want to keep and win office. But they don't have to do what this 19% or 36% of the people just said.
Well, but I think surely the way to get people out to vote is to inspire them. If the Democrats, and they appear to have always had a natural majority, the difference, I think, between the parties is that the Republicans seem to be able to get their people out, almost every one of their people out to vote, and the Democrats perennially have a hard time inspiring their people to vote. And this in this recent election, they really had a hard time inspiring people to vote because, as you've pointed out in this other article at Slate, A Victory for the Left, the amazing irony of this election was that the Republicans ran on issues that are to the left, that are traditional Democratic issues.
Right. Republicans picked up the message that Democrats didn't pick up, which was, look, even though we have aggregate job growth, aggregate economic growth, even though the numbers keep going in the right direction in aggregate terms, at the individual level, at the level of working class, middle class people, incomes have stagnated. By some measures, incomes have gone down. It was the Republican candidates, because they were running as the out party, they were running against a lot of Democratic incumbents, the Republicans actually made that point. They said things that you'd have to be a socialist in this country to say. They said, look, the investors, the shareholders, the corporate leaders, those guys are all doing really well. It's you little people whose incomes haven't gained in 15 years. And mind you, that's a Republican senatorial candidate, Cory Gardner in Colorado, saying that. And that 15 years covers not just the Obama years, but the Bush years. So that is quite an egalitarian, progressive critique of this economy and the policies of the last two presidents.
Well, preceding you on today's program, Will Salatin, we've been speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, who is the longest-serving independent, and we were discussing some of these issues, particularly the idea that the median household income in this country continues to drop. So when the Democrats, who didn't talk about it, but they do talk about recovery, and the White House does, the point is that the jobs may be coming back, but wages aren't.
Right. And I have to say that although what we're discussing here is a kind of a pessimistic situation in which there's been a stagnant economy and a failure of the left-leaning party to pick that issue up and run with it, even if you say, well, look, these Republicans are hypocrites, they don't really mean it, they won't really focus on it, I do think that it helps to change the conversation in the long run for an election to be about those indices. So if, you know, we shift from talking about economic growth, to talking about median income, to talking about the percentage of people in poverty, to talk about the real unemployment rate, underemployment, things like that, whether women are paid the same as men. That moves the conversation in this country to the left. It moves the conversation in a direction where the Progressive Party should be able to do better in future elections.
So the fact that that the Democrats did not run, in fact, they ran away from these issues that you just outlined, that is median income, wages, poverty, real unemployment, underemployment, and part-time work, and they also ran away from President Obama. Why didn't they, for example, address the two-thirds of Americans living paycheck to paycheck? And by the way, two-thirds of Americans didn't vote, so you almost can make that association. In fact, this recovery that Democrats are touting, 100% of the gains have gone to the best off 10%. 95% have gone to the top 1%. So we have a stock market that's booming. We have corporate profits through the roof, CEO pay off the charts, and tons of money in corporate bank accounts, by the way, record high. So I would think that some of those issues might have inspired people to come out to vote.
Yeah, well, I think that there was Democrats sort of felt that they had lost a lot of territory in the election, that they felt they couldn't argue about anything having to do with President Obama. So what President Obama's approval ratings sank. He was an albatross around their necks. The Republicans had an anti-Obama message, and Democrats just sort of felt like they couldn't win on those issues. So there was a lot of attempt to change the subject to, for example, social issues. Let's talk about the candidate that I'm running against. This Republican is too right-wing on abortion, for example. There were some folks, there was a lot of talk about the minimum wage. That somehow didn't seem to benefit the candidates. And of course, we all know that in five states, the minimum wage went 5-0 in this election. So even these conservative states that elected Republicans to the Senate or to the governorship, they voted, the voters voted for the minimum wage referenda. So they were with them on the policies, but I think Democrats tried to localize their elections, and that meant not talking about some of these pervasive, nationwide, in fact, global economic issues.
But Will Salatin, when you talk about the four red states in which the minimum wage raise initiative passed, that's South Dakota, Alaska, Nebraska, and Arkansas. In Arkansas, where it was on the ballot, where it passed handily, the Democratic incumbent running for his Senate seat prior refused to even mention it. And when it was on the ballot, ran away from it because he thought it tied into Obama, and it won handily. So, and equally puzzling is what happened in Kentucky with Mitch McConnell, where Alison Grimes, the Democratic challenger, refused to admit that she'd voted for Obama, treated him like he was associated with Ebola or something, and ran away from him as fast as she could. And then to the point where, because she was afraid of Obamacare and being tied to that. And guess what? Obamacare is incredibly popular in Kentucky, so much so that Mitch McConnell ran on the lie that he would get rid of Obamacare, but not in Kentucky.
Right. It's true. Look, we don't know what the election would have looked like if these folks had embraced President Obama, if they had had him come in to campaign for them. For all, you know, there are people who argue, look, they look at data and say it would have been even worse for Democrats. But we do know that this strategy failed. If we go across the Midwest, the South, the border states, and we look at those people who ran away from Obama, we certainly proved in this election, and the two examples you just cited make this point, we certainly proved that it is possible to bend over so far backwards to get away from the president and from the core of your party that you kind of break your back. Mark Pryor is an excellent example. Here is a guy who I think he voted against the Manchin-Toomey background check bill. He did everything possible to telegraph that he did not support traditional Democratic issues, didn't even support some fairly common sense things like background checks, like the minimum wage bill. And the result is, you know, at the end of the day, what did he stand for? He still was tarred as having, you know, being his opponent said that that Pryor had voted 93% with President Obama. People still voted for the Republican. And I have to say, Ian, I am quite moderate. You know, I've told people that I'm a liberal Republican. If the Republican Party of, you know, 40 years ago ever came back and said they'd like to be sane again, I'd be happy to vote for them. So I like moderates, but this was just gutless. And the Allison Grimes case, I mean, that was more than a policy statement on her part. That was just a statement that I'm not going to tell you the simplest thing about me. And I think a lot of voters were rightly offended by that.
Well, that's in itself pretty mind-boggling, if not brain dead, because obviously if you can't answer a simple question like that and you seem to be hedging, dodging, equivocating, being mealy-mouthed, you're not going to inspire people to think that you're able to talk about serious matters if you can't talk about trivial ones.
Right, and there were other candidates. Michelle Nunn, the Democratic nominee in Georgia, I'm sorry she lost because she ran a model campaign in so many ways, and she was quite candid in answering that question. Yeah, she voted for Obama, but here all, you know, she has connections to former President Bush 41. She has lots of, you know, moderate bipartisan credentials, but she just answered the question. I mean, that's not ideological. That's a character statement. That's, am I going to be honest with the public?
So we, of course, here in California, seem to be heading into the 21st century, while the country, arguably, in economic terms, is moving back to the 19th century, and perhaps in social terms, even to the 17th century. But we did have at least a candidate running against the popular governor, Jerry Brown, a Republican, who lived with the homeless. I mean, talk about make the point that you're making, Will Salatin, in your article, Victory for the Left, at Slate. You know, the idea that you had a Republican candidate literally was living with the homeless to talk about poverty and castigating the Democrats for not talking about poverty.
Well, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful if we had more Republicans who did that. And the truth is that even if the Republican Party doesn't want to do the right thing, the economic reality has a way of forcing you to deal with the real issues. So if we are in an economy where for 15 years median income does not increase, where the gains at the top are not spreading out, which is the promise of this country. The promise is not just economic growth. The promise is upward mobility, economic opportunity. That has to be real. It has to be manifest in numbers. If that is not happening, then people start to get restless. They start to be extremely unhappy with Washington. They don't care that you're quoting these numbers about job growth or about economic growth. And both parties, not just the Democrats, but the Republicans, will have to do more of that kind of work. They will have to talk about homelessness. They will have to talk about median income and poverty and whether, you know, it is really possible for a working class person to rise into a higher level, if not in this generation, then in the next.
So in terms of your other article at Slate, Will Salatin, Forget the Republican Mandate, looking forward, when you make the argument that in the next election that the Democrats and the Obamas, they should be concentrating on winning the next election rather than acceding to the Republican fiction that they have a mandate from this election, in terms of the horse race, and we're going to be afflicted by this for the next couple of years. I almost hate to talk about 2016 because it's just going to be so tiresome. But at this point, you know, it's largely Hillary Clinton, maybe on the other side, Mitt Romney or Jeb Bush or even Rand Paul as a kind of insurgent. But I was just speaking before you came on with Senator Bernie Sanders about the idea of him being on the debates, because if that's the lineup, it's going to be worse in 2016 than it, in terms of talking about issues that are traditionally on the left, but also, I think, resonate with the vast majority of American peoples, which is the argument you've been making.
Well, let me challenge you on that a little bit, because I think you're right about the nature of the candidates, but the candidates don't necessarily drive this. The candidates have to respond to the environment. And what I noticed, I have to tell you, Ian, I probably watched more of these candidate debates than anybody I know. I watched everything. And very frequently, these issues were brought up either by the Republican or by the moderators or the panelists who are asking the questions. And they're bringing them up because in every one of these states, in Oregon, in Connecticut, in Georgia, in Louisiana, in Colorado, these are the issues that are on people's minds. So there is, even if the candidates don't want to talk about economic inequality, about wage stagnation, about the decline of upward mobility, they will be forced to. They will be forced to because the panelists and reporters and the people who come to these debates, remember, people get to submit questions too. This is what's on their mind. And it's not just the people in the room. When you look at polling data, this is what's on people's minds. So that reality, if it persists in the next couple of years, and it seems that it will, that will drive the conversation to focus on these issues, whether or not Rand Paul wants to talk about it.
But in terms of getting into the presidential debates, which is certainly the dilemma that Bernie Sanders faced, since he's an independent and doesn't want to be a spoiler, at the same time, he wants to be in the Democratic debates. You know, I had Buddy Romer come out to a seminar that I do at UCLA a while back, and he tried to get into the debates in the last presidential elections, and you know there was a how many were there? They went on forever, and there was a huge field. But nobody, Roma, even though he kept meeting their thresholds, and they kept changing the rules on him. And frankly, having spent some time with Buddy Romer, I thought, my God, this guy is a hell of a candidate. He would have wiped the floor with these guys. So, can you make the case that these debates are rigged?
Well, first of all, I have to say I love Buddy Romer. It's funny that you brought him up. I remember him trying to get into those debates. I wrote a whole chapter in my book, Bearing Right, about Buddy Romer when he was governor of Louisiana, because he was a pro-lifer who was sincerely torn about how to regulate abortion and the character of the man, his complexity, very complex man, really came across. And I'm sorry he wasn't in those debates. To say that it's rigged, yeah, it is rigged in the sense that it's very hard to get in from outside the two major parties, and they generally make it difficult. Unless you're in some of these elections in 2014, the Republican wanted as many independents in the debate as possible so that the Democrat wouldn't get much time. But at the presidential level, that's true. All I can say is it is possible for somebody of a somewhat independent bent to make an impact in the primary debates if they run within a party. So if Bernie Sanders runs within the Democratic Party, it's possible to get in. John Anderson famously had a large effect in the 1980 election. He was an independent-minded person who ran as an independent but also ran as a Republican prior to that, and I think that that's one way into those debates. Ross Perot had an effect by running as an independent. So it is possible to push your way in, but you do have to meet a little bit higher than the technical threshold usually to make them pay attention to you.
But the examples you just cited, Will Salatin, they affected the Republicans adversely, both Ross Perot and John Anderson affected the Democrats, because if you run an independent on the left, you tend to diminish Democratic votes, and if you run an independent more to the right or the center, you'll hurt Republicans. I mean, the Republicans never forgave Perot. They felt that he basically elected Clinton.
Right. And, yeah, I'm sure that people would have that view about Bernie Sanders. That's certainly the way a lot of people felt about even Bill Bradley running in the primary against Al Gore. It's that Democrats do tend to want to discourage that. But I think that they're, you know, remember, over the next 2 years, the Republicans are going to control Congress. And what they do in those 2 years is probably going to frighten and upset Democrats and people who think like Democrats to such a degree that there will be some consolidation, that there will be some agreement within the Democratic Party on a counter agenda. And I think a lot of folks on the left will be relatively content with that.
Well, Will Salatin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Will Salatin, the national correspondent at Slate, who writes about politics, science, and technology. He's the author of Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War, and his recent articles at Slate are A Victory for the Left and Forget the Republican Mandate. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the U.S.-China climate deal just announced by Presidents Obama and Xi at the APEC summit in Beijing. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org and was a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And this deal that was announced at the APEC summit in Beijing by President Obama and President Xi Jinping of China, I guess the first questions that come up are whether these new pledges go far enough to address the dire crisis of global warming and whether China will be able to achieve them, not to mention can Obama, who will be facing a hostile Congress beholden to polluters like the Koch brothers who helped elect them. So let's start with the first. Are these pledges, do they go far enough?
Sure. Well, they're a very good first step, and let's make no mistake about it. This is an extremely important and auspicious development because what we now have are the world's two greatest carbon emitters coming to an agreement to take some very serious steps to reduce carbon emissions. Now, do they go far enough? Well, they set us on the right path. I mean, ultimately, we are going to need even more substantial carbon reductions than this agreement would lead to. I think in the case of the U.S., the president has committed to a 27 or 28% reduction of carbon emissions by 2025 relative to 2005 levels. Now, to put that in perspective, we probably need about 80% reductions relative to even earlier and lower 1990 levels by the middle of the century if we are to stabilize warming below the levels that where we envision truly dangerous and potentially irreversible impacts on the climate. So this sets us on the right path, but we will have to build substantially on this initial agreement if we are to achieve those sorts of reductions.
And the agreement commits China for the first time to a goal of peaking carbon emissions and getting 20% of its energy from non-fossil fuel sources by 2030. And I take it the disparity between 2025 for the U.S. and 2030 for China is simply that even though China is the number one polluter at the moment and the U.S. is the number two, the U.S. has been polluting a lot longer than China.
That's right. And so, you know, there's some horse trading going on here, clearly. There's a recognition that for the developing world, where there isn't a legacy of two centuries of cheap access to dirty fossil fuels, there is sort of this delicate dance when it comes to, well, you know, how much fossil fuel burning should we allow them to do now, given that they didn't have this legacy that we have? And so the restrictions are a little more lax. We're not talking about substantial reductions relative to 1990 levels here, because frankly, China wasn't doing all that much emitting back in 1990. But it is critical that we're talking about bringing their emissions to a peak when they continue to ramp up and escalate. And the single greatest threat to global carbon emissions right now is the escalating nature of China's carbon emissions over the last decade and a half. By bringing them to a peak and committing them to specific cuts in their carbon emissions, that is a major concession on their part. And what we really need is the industrial world to, you know, be making cuts of 80 to 90% in their carbon emissions, and the sort of developing world to be bringing their current emissions to a peak and begin to ramp them down. And so this agreement involves both. It involves the U.S. as a major industrial polluter historically to make substantial cuts in their carbon emissions while making sure that China doesn't continue to escalate their emissions.
So the second question then, Michael Mann, is whether China will be able to achieve these pledges that have just been made at the APEC summit in Beijing.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And, you know, I think we can look to their to the recent past for some degree of optimism. China, after all, has been investing more than we are here in the U.S. in renewable energy technology over the past several years. They are also ahead of us from a policy standpoint in that, you know, we've just elected now a Senate, a Republican Senate combined with a Republican House of Representatives for the next 2 years, where we are extremely unlikely to see any meaningful climate legislation come out of the U.S. Congress. Contrast that with China, where they are already instituting at the regional level cap-and-trade, carbon emissions cap-and-trade systems, and they are talking about instituting a carbon cap-and-trade system at the national level by 2016. So there's a certain level of irony here in that we hear from sort of climate change inactivists, those who don't think that we should be doing anything about the problem. You often hear from them the argument, well, why should the U.S. do anything when China, the greatest emitter of all, isn't doing anything to cut their emissions? Well, that argument now, you know, the final nail in that coffin is in, because China has actually been doing, by some measures, more than us, and now we have this historic agreement where China is firmly on record in making major commitments to lower their carbon emissions. So, you know, what China is doing is no longer a viable excuse for U.S. inaction.
Well, and I understand, though, for some, you know, some while back, China was building a new coal-fired power plant every 5 days. Now, apparently that slowed down. They broadened their portfolio into more wind and solar. They have a very small nuclear portfolio.
Yeah.
So where do they stand on that? Is that trend, I mean, the idea that you're trying to reduce CO2 emissions at the same time you're building coal-fired plants is completely counterintuitive.
No, that's right. And to some extent, you know, China has sort of been hedging their bets when it comes to energy generation over the past several years. They have, they at least for a while, were building coal-fired power plants at the rate of one every 5 days, just a huge amount of coal-burning infrastructure. But at the same time, they were investing more in renewable energy. And what we now see, as you say, is that they're moving increasingly towards a renewable energy portfolio. And just the fact that they're talking about instituting a cap-and-trade system in China means that they want to essentially institute market mechanisms that will help their economy transition away from fossil fuel burning. If there's a tax, you know, if there are permits, if there is a cost to burning carbon through a tradable emissions scheme, then that will essentially guide China increasingly towards renewable energy where there isn't that, there isn't that cost to be paid. So I think that, you know, if you look at what China is doing in terms of their policies, cap and trade system, you look at this latest agreement, you look at the fact that, as you allude to, they are moving more towards a renewable energy portfolio. There really is some reason, there really is reason for cautious optimism at this development.
Well, prior to this APEC summit in Beijing, the Chinese government shut down all of the coal plants and most of the industrial plants in the outer suburbs of Beijing because the air is simply unbreathable most of the time. And clearly, with all of these photo ops going on at the APEC summit, the Chinese leaders didn't want a bunch of world leaders wearing gas masks, you know?
Right.
So, give me a sense of how much, even though it's a top-down autocratic government run by an increasingly autocratic Communist Party, at least it's trying to reassert its authority, the people seem to be very upset in China about the air.
That's right, and I was there back in 2006, or 2005 rather, August 2005, when they were just getting ready for the Olympics, and you saw the problem then in Beijing. The air quality was awful, and of course the Olympics were televised internationally around the world, and so I think that this has been a public relations problem for China, but more than that, it's something that they're suffering from in terms of the health impacts and the cost of the damage to human health that their poor air quality has caused. They are paying the price for that, and they recognize that it makes far more sense to move away from fossil fuel burning towards clean energy, which won't contribute to the climate change problem that is going to impact them directly, which won't contribute to these air quality problems that are degrading health and incurring great health costs for China right now. So it just, at every level, it makes sense for them to move in this direction. It makes sense for the U.S. to be moving in this direction. And what's embarrassing, in a sense, is that the U.S. has always, we've always seen ourselves as leaders when it comes to innovation and when it comes to early adoption of new technology, more efficient technologies. That's been our history. And yet, when it comes to climate change, the rest of the world is moving ahead of us. The rest of the world sees the writing on the wall, and they're moving towards a renewable energy economy. We risk falling behind in terms of our competitiveness if we don't seize the moment and join the rest of the world. And that this latest agreement is going to help us do that.
Well, of course, one of the shameful statistics is the fact that Germany, which has very, very few sunny days compared to, say, here in Southern California, they've gone heavily into wind and solar. And,
that's right.
And just one day last year, a Sunday, the grid in Germany was more than 50% renewable energy.
Yep.
So they have really done remarkably well. And their targets, by the way, are based on starting from the floor of the 1990s.
Right.
Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that sounds correct to me. And it's amazing what's going on in Germany, where they are achieving now grid parity, which is to say that solar, the improvements in efficiency of solar photovoltaics and the deployment of that technology is such where it is now competitive with other forms of energy, even without taking into account the hidden cost of fossil fuel burning and the climate change damages that it's doing. So even without pricing carbon explicitly, they are already at a point where renewable energy is competitive with fossil fuel energy, and that's going to be true soon enough for the rest of the world. Now, we do need to put a price on carbon because we need to get there much sooner than we would if we didn't internalize in the economic decision-making the very real damage that carbon emissions are doing.
Well, in terms of the U.S. Congress and the new Congress in particular, we'll have Senator Jim Imhoff, the Republican from Oklahoma, who is a climate denier. He's set to become the head of the Senate's Environment and Public Works Committee.
Right.
And then you also have Mitch McConnell coming out immediately criticizing the deal just announced between the presidents of China and the United States on reducing CO2 and global warming gases. First time, of course, China has agreed to do it, which is in itself, I think, a fairly tectonic shift. Already, what Mitch McConnell, who of course, he comes from a coal state, he's saying the plan is unrealistic. He's saying it's a part of the president's war on coal agenda, and that he was particularly distressed by the deal because he feels that Obama doesn't want to move towards the middle by negotiating with Republicans. So how can you move towards the middle when you've got people like Jim Imhoff, Senator Imhoff, who is a climate change denier? He's not in the middle. He's way out on the fringes of reality.
Yeah, I mean, you know, moving to the middle when you've got truth, scientific truth on one side and scientific falsehood on the other, you know, in the middle is not correct. In the middle is not acceptable. The science is very clear. Climate change is already a problem. It's costing us in terms of the damage it's doing, food, water, health, national security, our economy. It's already costing us. It's not only happening, it's not only that it's due to human activity, but that it is already a problem. And that's what the world scientific community has concluded. And that was there was an exclamation mark on that coming out of this latest IPCC Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. It makes it very clear that climate change is a risk that we need to deal with. And there's a worthy policy debate to be had, and we should be having that debate in Congress about what how we're going to tackle that problem and how we are going to deal with those risks. That's a worthy topic for debate. What is not a worthy topic for debate is whether the problem exists, whether those risks exist. And there can be no middle ground on that point because the science is very clear on it. Where there is opportunity for good faith debate, policy debate, is you know, how we go about pricing carbon. And fortunately, there are conservatives like Bob Inglis, a conservative former congressman from South Carolina, who are leading the effort to discuss and to present conservative, sort of market-driven approaches to pricing carbon. And that's a great discussion. We should be having that discussion. We should have conservatives and progressives at the table, and we should be weighing these different options. But we can no longer pretend that the risk doesn't exist. And unfortunately, James Inhofe, who you mentioned, will be the new chair of the House Environment and Public Works Committee, is somebody who holds a firmly anti-scientific position when it comes to climate change. He has argued that climate change is an elaborate hoax, that the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and every scientific society in the U.S. that's weighed in on the matter, which has concluded that climate change is real, is caused by us, and it represents a risk. To argue that the entire world's scientists and scientific organizations have conspired in some kind of hoax is really an insult to the scientific community, and it very poorly serves our public discourse on this issue.
Well, but he represents Oklahoma, which is an oil-producing state. And, you know, the problem, I think, Michael Mann, the reason why there's a huge gap between the science and political efforts to address this looming crisis of global warming is quite simply that those people who want to keep the carbon economy going and keep making zillions and zillions of dollars are simply opposed to it, and they have the money. You in the scientific community, you got the facts, but they've got the money.
Well, yeah, and Inhofe, you know, has betrayed this in some of his comments in a gaffe from earlier this year, where he actually said that he used to accept the science behind climate change until he learned how much it would cost. And I think that's almost verbatim what he said, how much it would cost to deal with the problem. And so what you see here is that the refusal to accept the science is just a proxy for an ideological viewpoint, an unwillingness to accept that we need to do something about our carbon emissions. If you can pretend that the problem doesn't exist, then, of course, you can dismiss the solutions to the problem. And unfortunately, that's where folks like James Inhofe are. Let's hope that more enlightened voices dominate the discussion in the years ahead in our U.S. Congress.
Well, I hope so, too. But I wouldn't hold my breath, Michael Mann, because this is a Congress that's shown that it's pretty hostile to the idea of climate change and dealing with it. And this new Congress is even more hostile, since so many of them were elected with money from the Koch brothers, who are among the country's biggest polluters. But you did mention earlier improved efficiency. You mentioned in the context of solar power. But isn't that the simplest way that you can make real progress, like almost overnight in this country?
Yeah.
If you had a national regime of energy efficiency, it's not going to cost very much, certainly nothing compared to what the climate change deniers are claiming.
Yeah.
And it could be done, implemented very quickly. So who's going to lead that charge, do you think?
Yeah. Well, it's ironic, isn't it? Because the very same forces, the same institutions, individuals, the Koch brothers, you know, who are behind this, you know, hundreds of million dollar campaign to discredit the science of climate change, are also investing tens of millions of dollars through groups that they fund, like ALEC, to do everything they can to essentially stymie efforts at the state level to incentivize clean energy. And it got so bad that a year ago, Tea Party, Republican-driven politicians within the state of North Carolina were attempting to pass legislation to make it illegal to sell Tesla electric cars in the state of North Carolina. That's how really the level of bad faith that now lies behind this effort to, you know, to forestall the sort of growth of renewable energy, because it is indeed the greatest threat to the fossil fuel industry. And so it isn't enough for them to try to stymie efforts to cut our carbon emissions and deal with the climate change threat. They're also funding a smear campaign against renewable energy, and that just is not acceptable.
Well, but if you had sensible people in the Congress, first of all, with interest rates as low as they've been, you'd have an enormous amount of infrastructure spending. You could put millions and millions of Americans back to work, particularly in the construction sector, which has been depressed since the crash of 2008. You could be insulating homes and doing all of those things which would cut our energy output enormously and almost do it immediately. So there's an awful lot that can be done. It's just very depressing that we have a political environment that is so out of step with the American people.
No, you're right. And, you know, because in many of the detractors say, well, you know, we believe in market-driven solutions. We don't believe in regulation. And yet they are doing everything they can to interfere with the market's own mechanisms for dealing with this problem by blocking efforts to incentivize more efficient clean energy, you know, electric vehicles. And so, ironically, if they just left the market alone, we would probably make far more significant advances here. But they're actually not happy to even do that. They want to rig the rules in such a way that the market de-incentivizes the solutions to this problem.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's a co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website, realclimate.org, and was a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.